I have 13 parrots, 10 chickens, 5 bunnies, 3 dogs, a guinea pig, and a tortoise named Rock Hudson. Most of them are adopted from like rescues or people abandoning. I love parrots so much. Like, they have the best personalities. They're so smart. Yeah, if someone's like, I have this parrot and I can't take care of it anymore, I'm like, okay, bring it on over. And I just love it. It's like I work at a petting zoo.
Hi, welcome to the Growth Mixtape Podcast, and I'm your host, Bob Mathers. We have one rule here. We're going to chase our curiosity way outside our comfort zones. The more uncomfortable and awkward, the better. We're going to talk to people you've never heard of doing jobs you didn't know existed. We're going to hear human stories about the things that connect us, what we can learn from one another, and what we can take away to apply to our own lives. These conversations might not seem to have a lot in common at first, but just like songs on a mixtape, we create something memorable and emotional. Today we talk to Chris Paul Rainbows, a storyteller, strategist, and queer educator on a mission to make everyone feel like they belong. Chris talks about growing up queer in a small border town, struggling with OCD and anxiety, building a successful company only to have a breakdown, and tearing it all apart to start over. We touch on pride as a mix of celebration and rebellion, what it means to be an ally, and how this is not the oppression Olympics. We all have hard stories that make us who we are, and we have to embrace them to find our people. But the best part is the stories, every one of them full of joy and hope. We've got a pumpkin empire, gay cakes, and a tortoise with a prolapsed butthole named Rock Hudson. If you've ever struggled to find your voice or need inspiration to chase a bigger life, Chris will make you believe anything is possible. Or maybe you just need some 100% joy in your life today. Please enjoy Chris Paul Rainbows. Chris, I'm so excited for this conversation. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here, Bob.
Me too. So we're right in the middle of Pride Month. So what is that like for you?
Oh, being middle 40s, in my mid 40s, it's a lot different than when I was in my 20s. Because I used to do a lot of parades, a lot of partying, a lot of bars. And that was so much fun. I think, you know, Pride, we have to remember that Pride started as a protest, an uprising, in 1969, the Stonewall riots. And it's still a protest today. We're still fighting for rights. We're still fighting, for queer people, but that doesn't mean we can't celebrate how far we've come and all of the things we do. And that's the, you know, the queer joy part. I celebrate queer joy just by being who I am, living my life and putting it out there. And specifically in Pride Month, because I don't go to, even like parades are too, they're too hot. There's too many people. I can't. But I do a lot of talks. I do a lot of talks at like community centers, congregations, people who want to be better allies and understand like the steps to take to be better allies. And I also do a lot of kids book readings at family pride days, which are absolutely just a joy. So spreading queer joy is my thing all year round, but like I pump it up during Pride Month.
Well, there's so much of that that I'm excited to get into. Yeah, I remember, I've never been to a Pride parade, but I've seen, you know, seen it all on TV a lot. And I just remember thinking like, nobody is having more fun than those guys.
Right?
Like, it looks like Mardi Gras. It looks like sex and drugs and partying for days. It's just like, oh my God, it just looks like the most amount of fun.
Well, it depends on where you go and who you are and what you're into. And there's something for everyone. So there's everything from those nightclubs and drag queens to, you know, the family pride where there's books and activities and, you know, family, families get together. So there's something for everyone. So I was like, I don't want to go to Pride. You know, I don't want to see those things at Pride. It's like, well, what part of Pride are you going to? Because maybe that's not the Pride part for you, because at the end of the day, it's still about, you know, sexual liberation. It's about identity. It's about all of these things. So to say like you don't want to see any of these things happening, well, that's what it's about too. It's about all of those freedoms. And if you don't want to see it, don't go to it. Go somewhere else. And that's okay.
Yeah.
I think you do good at Pride, though. You're a very handsome person, if I may say so myself. You do very good at a Pride parade.
It does look like a lot of fun. But like you, I'm older, and now I just look at it and be like, oh, that looks hot and sweaty and busy and crowded. And
right? It's like, I don't go to IKEA on Sunday, and I don't go to a Pride parade for the same reasons.
Oh, yeah, I love that. Okay, so let's step back a bit. You just mentioned a few things, and there's so many things I'm excited to get into, Chris. You grew up in a small town. So growing up not far from here, you grew up in Hamilton, is that right?
No, I actually grew up just outside of Windsor. It's a small town called Kingsville, which is right next to Leamington, which is the tomato and ketchup capital of Canada. But it was a very small town, like very rural, like a Gilmore Girls type of village town. So yeah, in the 80s.
It's funny. I was just talking to somebody today. There's something about border towns that have a unique kind of personality and character to them.
Oh, for sure. There's things like we would get American television, American radio stations, and there's like crossing the border all of the time. Like you just know when you're on the bridge to get to the States and like the locks, your parents put the locks down and they turn around and they go, don't say anything. Because you're going over, right, to buy all of your clothes for school. You go over in a t-shirt and the worst pair of shoes you have, and you come back with like 30 layers of clothes on because they don't want to pay the duties. And you're like, anything to declare? And I'm like, nope. I don't know if you can get away with that now, but that was in the 80s.
You're right. I think things have changed. So when people ask you what it was like growing up queer in a small town, in a border town, like, I mean, it's a giant question, but what do you tell them?
It was very isolating. There was, especially in that time when there was no representation on television, if I did see someone who was gay, they were either like, they weren't really out, you know, like the Paul Lind type characters where they weren't saying that they were gay, but you kind of knew, or there were jokes about like men dressing up as women, and it was always very negative. So, you know, seeing that on television, like, uh-oh, that's what I am. And these people are either laughing at them, all the adults are either laughing at them or they don't like them. What am I supposed to do? And then growing up Catholic, going to the church and sitting in the pew and hearing a priest say that you are a sin, and you're sitting there going, oh my gosh, like they're talking about me. Like it was really hard. It was very hard. So, you know, there's no community, there's no one to talk to. And I just felt like I needed to get out of there.
So when did you leave?
The minute that I turned 18 and applied for college, and I went to Windsor, which is the big city, and there was a community there. And then after I graduated, I moved to London for work, and then I moved to Hamilton, and that's kind of like where I really found a community, a queer community, but just a community in general. That Hamilton is very, I think it's because they're very a working town, NDP kind of people, and they were very accepting and like the socialist kind of gang.
Yeah. One of the things you've talked about, Chris, pretty openly is kind of your struggles with mental health. I mean, is that something you kind of, that was always with you as you were growing up and trying to find your way through, you know, getting out of that small town and moving to the big city?
I think so. I think I've always had OCD and ADHD, and I don't think it was necessarily, like, I think I missed the cohort when they started to diagnose ADHD. But being an entrepreneur, I started a business in Hamilton, and I never thought about, like, okay, what do I want? I just saw, you know, on television, it's like, well, you have to, if you're going to have a marketing company or an agency, you're going to have this big agency with all these employees and these, you know, open space concept with beanbag chairs and a foosball table somewhere. And I was like, okay, I guess that's what I got to have. And I got it because I have a lot of drive. But it took so much to get that it like wore on me and wore on me. I was working 16, 18 hours a day. I had 12 employees and I was doing things that I didn't want to do, like managing people and not doing the actual work that I love to do. And that stress kind of ignited my OCD. And OCD, I don't want to get too much into OCD, but it's actually really debilitating and more serious than a lot of people think it is. They think it's like organizing or, you know, like keeping the house clean. And like, it can be that, but it's not about that. It's about the obsession that you have, and the compulsion is the cleaning. Maybe you have a fear of germs, but it's the germs are going to kill you and your family. So you've got to clean the whole house, and it's never clean enough. And those thoughts keep going and going and going. And it broke me down to the point where I could not leave my house for over a month. The obsession was just going on and on in my head. And I didn't leave my bed. And my husband, I said to him, you know, I can't do this. I can't be on this planet anymore. And I contemplated suicide. I attempted suicide, or at least I tried to. But, and my husband said, listen, you know, you can't see the light at the end of this tunnel, but I can see it. I'm going to be right here until you can see it too. And that's when, you know, he took me to a doctor and I got help and medication. I saw a therapist and I started to address these issues, the root causes, what they, one of the most important things when it comes to mental health is being able to, name what it is so that you have something. Because I didn't know what this was. I just thought I was going crazy. And when you get a name, you go, oh, it's OCD. Then I can look that up. I can understand it more. I can understand how I am living with this. And that's when I found help.
So you get therapy and treatment, and that's amazing. You come out the other side. So you talked about your work environment and how that was weighing on you. So is it at this point where you decided, yeah, this isn't for me and I'm going to try to do something different?
Yeah, totally. I kind of got out of that OCD depression, and I realized I didn't define what happiness was for me in my life. I just let the world dictate what happy looked like. And I thought, what do I want? And I looked around, and I said, I don't want all of these things. I don't want an office. I love people, but I don't want to manage their workloads and do any of that stuff because I'm not good at it. So I like completely rearranged my life. And then I proposed to my husband because I was like, well, anybody who, you know, is going to say, I'll be here until you can see the light at the end of the tunnel too. Like, I was like, I got to lock that down because that's good stuff. So we decided to get married. I left my business. And I started up my own business, the Unicorn Rebellion. And it's basically everything that I love to do at my old business, but I got to do it. I was hiring people to do all that stuff. And I was like, no, I want to do that stuff. And it's also like, you know, when you have a business, you've got to bring in so much money a month to keep the lights on, to pay the employees, and all of their life depends on you providing. And that's a huge responsibility. I don't think a lot of people understand. And so that means you can't turn anybody away. You got to say, okay, yeah, I got to work with you. I got this month's low. We're working with anybody. And now I can go, okay, I don't need even close to $60,000 a month to live. I can be like, you know what? This isn't a right fit. This isn't going to work. Or like, oh my gosh, this is exactly the kind of project I want to work on, which keeps my stress levels low. It's all about managing my stress so that I don't fall back into that thought process of OCD. So yeah, I changed everything, and it's been amazing. And we moved to a smaller community where they allowed backyard chickens, because I was like, that's going to help my stress if I have some little chickens walking around my backyard. And yeah, we've been so happy.
You don't have just chickens, right? Walk me through the list of barnyard animals you've got roaming around back there.
Sure. I have 13 parrots, 10 chickens, 5 bunnies, 3 dogs, a guinea pig, and a tortoise named Rock Hudson. Most of them are adopted from like rescues or people abandoning. I love parrots so much. Like, I am I have had birds all my life. They have the best personalities. They're so smart. So yeah, if someone's like, I have this parrot and I can't take care of it anymore, I'm like, okay, bring it on over. And I just love it. It's like I work at a petting zoo.
Man, my eyes are swelling shut with my allergies just listening to that. Like bunnies and parrots.
Luckily, I don't have any of those allergies. Thank God.
Okay, so a couple of stories I wanted to hear from you on. Tell me about this pumpkin empire thing that happened.
Okay, so I planted 4 pumpkins 1 year because I was like, I want to see. I never planted pumpkins. I really got into gardening and I planted them and they were great. And after Halloween, I threw them in my compost because I was like, I'm doing compost. Like I turned into like Martha Stewart. Like we're doing everything in the backyard. We're doing the whatever they call it, like that. I don't know, homesteading or whatever that all the kids are talking about now. So I put them in the compost and the next year I had the most beautiful compost. Like, oh my gosh, it was like brown gold. It was gorgeous. So I put it throughout my entire garden, but I didn't realize that you're supposed to take the seeds out of the pumpkins before you put them in the compost. So I had all of a sudden looking around my garden, I was like, I thought they were weeds. I'm looking, I'm like, oh my gosh, these are pumpkin plants. There were over 300 pumpkin plants that I had spread out throughout my whole house. And my husband comes out, I'm like, these are pumpkin plants. He's like, oh, just pull them. I'm like, this is the best mistake that's ever happened. Let's see what we're going to get here. Like, what are you talking about? Pull them out. Are you crazy? So I just let them grow and they were, oh my gosh, if you've never seen a pumpkin plant, they are huge. Like they are long vines. The leaves are like literally from Jurassic Park and they were climbing up my house. I built a house so that it would like, they would cover it. I call it the pumpkin house and it completely covers it. They were going into my neighbor's yard, up her tree, and it was fantastic. And I think I got probably 100,000 followers on TikTok just from my pumpkin journey. So I was like, Jared, you wanted to pull them all out. Well, now I have 100,000 more followers. So who is right? Listen to me. And so then I let them grow and I got 167 pumpkins. And I was like, what am I going to do with all of these pumpkins? Like, I can't, like, it's just so many. So I had this idea. We have a fund called the Unicorn Fund where we raise money for the queer community in Hamilton. And I contacted a not-for-profit childcare center. And I said, hey, I want to come in. I want to bring the pumpkins for all the kids. I want to read The Great Pumpkin. And so I went there and I read the book to them. And I said, you know, The Great Pumpkin, if you all have the most sincere pumpkin patch, because you all have pumpkins now, The Great Pumpkin is going to come on Halloween and he's going to bring you a gift. And it was so beautiful because, like, I wasn't even thinking in this moment. And this one kid where I was reading held up this one pumpkin. I had made a video out of 167 pumpkins. I made a specific video about this pumpkin, because it was my favorite one. And he held it up. Like, it's crazy kismet. And I went, oh my gosh, that's my favorite of all of them. And he walked up to me and he saw how happy I was about it. And he gave it back to me. And I said, thank you so much. And all of the kids saw how happy that made me. And they started bringing me their pumpkins. Now I didn't want them back because I was like, I don't want any of these pumpkins. But I realized that they did have the most sincere pumpkin patch. They were all being so sincere. And like how kids just are born with this, and you know that sincerity and empathy is beat out of us when it comes so naturally. So on Halloween, my fund bought $2,000 worth of kids books, and we delivered it and said it was from The Great Pumpkin, and it was like one of the most magical, like they loved it. It was just, I always like to take, you know, you can find opportunity in anything. Like everything has a little bit of magic in it, and you just gotta like find it and then like use that magic for good.
Well, there's so much about that I love when you go back, Chris, and you talk about, yeah, why would we pull these out? Like, let's just see them. Let's just let them grow and see what happens. And then that image of that little boy giving you this, your perfect pumpkin pack back. I mean, that would never have happened. What a beautiful kind of,
never. They're so sincere with their love and their kindness and their empathy. It's just, kids are amazing.
Hey, it's Bob, and I'm taking the Growth Mixtape on the road in a series of keynote speeches inspired by the stories of my amazing guests. At their core, these signature talks are about how to get you and your teams off autopilot and stop settling for small incremental improvements. This isn't going to come from spewing business advice. My podcast is full of people that have done incredible things, and every one of them struggles with self-doubt, imposter syndrome, and the crippling fear of judgment that holds so many of us back. They've also found ways through it by rediscovering their creativity, their curiosity, and the confidence to do scary things. Imagine the power of bringing these vulnerable stories to life, live and on stage, to help you and your teams hit your targets, find your voice, and be the rock stars you are. Book me for your next event at bobmathers.ca. Now back to the show. The other thing I wanted to ask you about too in that story, so what do you think it was that drew those 100,000 followers? Because on the surface of it, it's like, okay, there's this weird story about these pumpkins. Like, why? What is it about that story that seemed to resonate with so many people?
Well, I think that what people don't realize about getting followers, I want a lot of followers, I got to make all this content. And I have narrowed it down to about 3 videos on my TikTok that have got me the most followers. We all want to know how the story ends, right? So putting up that one video where you're dancing, you're singing, that's fun. But like, I don't need to follow you. That was great. Thank you for that. But when you put up that story and you start it, everybody wants to see where it goes. And that's what it was. It was me going, look at all of these pumpkin plants. What am I going to do now? And everyone went, follow. I want to know what they're going to do now. So give them a reason to be part of your story. And I incorporated comments. People were telling me what to do with them. Like, you should take them to an animal sanctuary. You should. And I would address them. I'm like, that's a really great idea. Maybe I will take some of them, like interacting with those people afterwards. So many people just put up content and like, they don't realize all of the gold is in the comments. Like, those people are reaching out to you. And don't get me wrong, I get a lot of crappy content, comments, like horrible, mean comments, but there's so much beauty in that comment section. And that's how not only grow an audience, but you nurture and maintain your audience so that when something happens that's actually like really important that you want to share, you've got all of those people who are your I don't know, they're like your army. They're your friend army who are like, oh, Chris has got something important, we're going to share it. You know, it's like we forget about that ongoing relationship back and forth.
Yeah, I love that. What was your second video? You said there were 3 big ones. What was the second one?
I don't know what the third one was, but the second one was actually, I don't know how political we want to get, but it was Marjorie Taylor Greene. I don't know if you know who Marjorie Taylor
Greene. Oh, yeah.
She camped outside of Drag Queen Storytime place, and she was like, they're reading books to children. She was making this video, and they're disgusting and blah, blah, blah. And at the time, I was doing Drag Queen Storytime. I've retired from that, but I was doing it, and I addressed her, and I basically said, no, they're not disgusting, and here's what they're reading. They're reading, I have all my books here. You know, they're reading about identity. They're reading about solidarity. They're reading that Timmy has 2 moms and Molly has 2 dads. And that is a family too. And we're not going to stop. We are not going to stop until you stop. Because you are the reason. The only reason I have to go in to schools to read these books is because you're teaching kids hate. And I'm trying to undo that hate. So when you stop, I will stop. And that got I think it was 130,000 followers, and I think it got 500, half a million likes. That's not even views. That's people who clicked on it. I went to a school recently, and I was literally invited by the school. They paid me to be there to talk to a bunch of high schoolers about finding your purpose and all this stuff. And I got a comment saying, yeah, they'll find anything, any way to get close to the kids. Like, I was doing something dirty by being paid to be a speaker at a high school. Like, are you kidding me? And this is just a way that, you know, we dehumanize whoever they want to target at the time. You know, right now we're targeting, what a big one is, immigrants. That's the they. Sorry, I went on a whole, like, Norma Rae rant there because I'm passionate about that. It you know? Like, we're going to be on here for an hour. Every 45 seconds, a queer kid in North America attempts suicide. Attempts. Every 45. In just this hour, how many is that? That's right on the Trevor Project. That is, like, confirmed research. And we're not going to be someone to speak up for that. I'm going to be, because it, like, literally, it takes one accepting adult in that queer kid's life to drop that number by 60%. That's all it takes. And, like, acceptance is the easiest thing to do. We're not telling you need to celebrate. I might tell you should celebrate and you should, you know, do all of the other. It's like, accept? You can't accept that? That's where my passion is. Because I was that kid. Sorry.
Are you kidding me? Don't apologize. What you said something before, Chris, about, you know, kids aren't born this way, right? Like, yeah, we have no choice, I guess, but to spend our lives battling the Marjorie Taylor of the world. But if we can just get to the kids before they're have all of this hate drilled into them.
Yeah. And it's, so it's not about going in there and trying to turn anyone or, you know, infiltrate their brains. It's just about showing them who else lives on this planet and that we should be kind to them.
Yeah. One question I have about that, Chris, is I wonder from your perspective if it's getting better, because just a bit of context, I was born in 1970, right? Like, I didn't know any gay people growing up. And I'm sure I knew gay people. They sure as hell wouldn't have been comfortable coming out in the community that I lived in. Calling somebody gay or queer was the worst insult that you could call somebody. And we used it liberally.
Yeah.
And so when I look back, and I'm not making any excuses for it, but when I look back, I'm like, okay, in half a lifetime, it seems like the conversations have evolved and it seems like we've made a lot of progress. But that's from my perspective. Looking in, like, do you see that as progress?
Well, the first thing I want to start with is the reason, you know, I love how you said that it's the worst thing that you could have been called as a kid, being gay or being queer, or being the F slur. And we kind of have to look at the root of that. The root of that is misogyny. Why they were calling you that is because they were saying that there's nothing worse than acting, looking, dressing like a woman. And if you were acting, talking, wanting to be close to that, you know, feminine, there's something wrong with you. And everything, it all leads back to this hatred for women, even drag queens. You're disgusting dressed like that. Why? Do you think women are disgusting? Like, what? Trans women, you're never going to be a real... It's all about this hatred towards women. And do I think that has changed? Yeah, I think a lot has changed. Like, when you were born, I don't even think women in Canada could have a credit card in their own name. I think that happened in like 1976 or something like that. So yeah, there are things that have changed. I met my husband, I think, 2 years after it became legal to get married in Canada? Like, there was, when I was a kid, that wasn't even an option. That was like, I was like, well, I'm never getting married ever. I don't know why I'm doing this project in high school where it's like, you have to like plan your wedding. I think it was home ec or something. It's like, well, I'm not getting married. So yeah, things happen, but things keep getting pushed back. The more liberation we get, the more people want to squash that and keep us down. And when there's no liberation for anyone until there's liberation for everyone, women, queer people, like everyone. So yeah, I do think that there's steps and then there's steps back that happen. And we've seen that with the trans community right now. They're being demonized and weaponized, and so much misinformation that it has kind of put us back, but that doesn't mean we're going to stop the fight. And that's what Pride is all about, right? It's about continuing that fight, but also celebrating that joy while we're fighting.
Yeah. And I do think it's so interesting. I was talking to a mentor about this, you know, preparing for this conversation today. And I do have a lot of hope, as you said, when we talk about our kids. Like, my kids are in their early 20s. And I think, I don't know how to sum up their point of view on it, other than, like, I don't get what the big deal is. Girls love girls and boys love boys, and they love a boy one day and they love a girl next day. Like, I really don't think they care. So hopefully it's just that it's a thing that we just have to wait.
Oh, 100%. And this is another reason I absolutely loved going to high schools to talk, because I walk out of there so refreshed of like, okay, the future is not doomed. Because like, I'm going in there to talk about these things, and they're looking at me over like, I know that. I know right. All of those things. I'm woke. I'm more woke than you're woke. And I was like, oh yeah, I guess you are. So like, coming out, I'm just like, okay, the future. And that's my hope. That's like what gets me through, is like, okay, they're coming up. They're speaking out. They're not putting up with this stuff. And that gives me hope. So I think, yeah, your kids are right in that generation.
One of the things you talk a lot about, Chris, is helping people find their voice. And this is something that really resonates with me. And I guess we've touched on it a little bit, but I'm just wondering why that means so much to you. And what does that mean to you, helping people find their voice?
Sure. So I think a lot of people think that finding your voice means like literal, like the ability to speak out and, demand or ask or, but really what, for me, it's about finding what you're really passionate about. What do you want to change? What do you want to see better? How do you want to leave this world better than when you came into it? What are those things? That's what I think finding your voice is. And it's not about how loud you are, because you can advocate for those things in so many different ways, from, you know, going into politics or writing poetry, writing music. I do it through speaking or writing kids' books. So it's really about finding who you are and what you believe in. And if we all found that one thing, if every single person on the planet was like, this is the thing that I am so passionate about that I want to change, that this will make the world so much better, the world would be so much better if we all just like found that and found a way to not stifle it, but let it out, and however you want to let that out.
Yeah. And one of the things, so I love that. One of the things that I was thinking about too, Chris, is, and this is something that I struggle with, and I talk to other people about it too. So in terms of finding my voice, I also think about it in terms of like, what unique talents or point of view do you have to offer the world that nobody else can provide? And so when I get on social media, I write content, I get up on stage, I talk about my struggles with alcohol and losing my dad early, and we almost lost my son last year, and so how those experiences shaped me. But I also see people like you or people from other marginalized communities who have had probably objectively a harder time or have harder experiences. And so I think like, what right do I have as a middle-aged white guy with a full head of hair, straight, like, how hard could my life really
You've
be?
You've got pretty privilege. And, you know that, right?
Yeah. Well, exactly. That's what I'm saying. And so I'm like, well, who wants to hear my struggles when there's lots and lots of people that have harder struggles than me? But the point is, I guess, that I'm belaboring to make is that there's always somebody that has a harder story than yours. And so I think people don't want to speak up because they don't feel like their story has enough weight compared to some of the others that they're hearing.
You know, it's like, it's not the oppression Olympics. We're not all competing to be the most oppressed, and that we can't speak out if we're not the most oppressed. It's really about understanding your story, where where your point of view is coming from. I think, you know, talking about your struggles in alcoholism, you're not stepping on any toes, but what's really important is understanding the privilege you have. I have privilege as a queer person. I am white. I, most of the time, am male presenting. People think I'm a man, so I have male privilege. You know, there's so many different kinds of privileges. Like, I went to college. I speak English in the country that I was born. Like, there's so many privileges. Understanding those things is so important, and not feeling bad about them. People are like, it's not my fault. I, you know, that I'm privileged. It's like, no, we're not saying it's your fault, but you are. Acknowledge it and use it for good. You have privilege, like you just said. And so what does that privilege mean to you? That means when you get into that door, how are you making the door stay open a little longer for that woman to follow you in? It's not about feeling guilty about being able to go up that ladder, go through that door. That's the society we live in.
Yes, it's something that I need to think about more. It feels like a lot of pressure.
Well, you know what it is? It's pressure because there's something called... your social currency. Sorry, it's social capital, not social currency. That's like our interactions with our friends or the privileges we have. Like you have, you know, privileges to be friends with someone who knows me and that social currency. And we're afraid to kind of damage that currency that we have by speaking up. So if I go in there and I go, who else is in here? Do you have an Indigenous voice? Are you talking to Black people? I could, like, that could be not welcomed. I could lose some social capital in doing that. They would go, we're not asking Chris to do anything anymore. If you want to call yourself an ally in any of the, you actually shouldn't be calling yourself an ally. That's a word that somebody should be calling you. But, like, if you're trying to be an ally, some of that social capital's got to go.
Okay, you just hit on something, this idea of allyship. So it's not something that you should be calling yourself, but something that other people call you. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, sure. So, and I always say, even though it's not, I say allyship is an action word, because it's not about what you've done. It's about what you continue to do and what you're willing to do in the future. So like, you could be an ally today. That doesn't mean you're going to get your ally card and you're like, okay, I'm done with it. And also you don't get to tell someone if you were an ally to them. They'll tell you if you were being an ally. And it's not something that anybody should want to pin on themselves. Like, I'm an ally to the queer community. It's like, no, just say like you support the queer community or whatever, because I guarantee you, you're going to make a mistake. I try to be an ally every day. Do I fail? All of the time. That's why I don't call myself an ally. Let's say I don't call myself an Olympic anything. Do I walk to the mailbox sometimes? Yes. And I'm not an Olympian though. I'm never going to get to that, you know, point, but I try every day to be an ally. And that's the thing. You can try to be an ally. You don't have to. There's no end game, though. You're not going to get a gold star. You're not going to get a cookie. There's no finish line. It just keeps going and going. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And okay. It's aspirational, and the kind of goalposts are always moving.
Exactly.
Something else that you've said before that I thought was really beautiful, Chris, you said, curiosity is beautiful, but responsible curiosity, that's allyship. Responsible curiosity. That's interesting. Why did you pick those words?
I don't know exactly where that came from, but I think in what I was trying to say is that the curiosity of trying to find out more about community. So like wanting to get to that I'm an ally, or I'm in the process of being an ally all of the time. It's great to have curiosity. So I want to learn about, let's say, I keep using the Indigenous community because I'm not Indigenous, but I'm queer, so it makes sense. So I want to learn about the Indigenous community. That doesn't mean I go up to Indigenous people and go, tell me about your community. It's putting work onto marginalized community, and they've already got a lot of work to do, let me tell you. They are putting out fires. They are, you know, like hate coming from everywhere. So don't just expect them to educate you. Don't expect them to have the answer for you. All of the stuff's out there. Like, start Googling. And if you're going to ask that question, and I ask all the time. I have an Indigenous friend who I ask all the time. And the first thing I say to her is, do you have the capacity to hear my question at the moment about the Indigenous community? And sometimes she says, totally. And sometimes she goes, no, I don't have the capacity to do it. And then I go, just drop it. It's not her responsibility to teach me. So that's what that's about. It's about being respectful to the work that marginalized people are already doing, not giving them a bigger workload to do, but being curious and wanting to understand. There's nothing wrong with that. Just be respectful when you do so.
Yeah. So yeah, I love that. Do you have the capacity to hear my question? That's interesting.
I ask that all of the time, not just to marginalized people. I will ask that to friends, family. Do you have the capacity for this? It was learned by one of my friends, Melanie Sodka. She her whole thing is the capacity, is about capacity. And I just find it so respectful. And I've started to get people to ask me that, like, do you have the capacity right now? And like, do you have the emotional capacity to hear this right now? And sometimes I go, you know what? I don't have the, thank you so much for asking me. Cause people just start to trauma dump in your direct messages. Like all of a sudden you're just like, and I'm like, I can't read all of that. I'm not emotionally stable at the moment. So it's just a respect.
Oh, I love that. One thing you mentioned earlier, and I know this is something, Chris, you talk about. You were talking about talking to the high school students about purpose and happiness. I've got my own point of view on it. I like to share it, but I struggle with providing a unique...
Ooh, yes, share it with me.
Well, I struggle with providing a unique point of view on this. So what is your outlook on helping, whether it's young adults or corporations you talk to around purpose and happiness? Like, how do you view that?
Well, I always start with saying that happiness is, like anything, a social construct. What happiness is to you is not what happiness means to me. And if you don't define it for yourself, someone is going to define it for you, or it's just not going to happen. And you're going to get to the point where you don't even recognize where you are in life. And you're like, wait a minute, how did I get here? Just like my story. And I think everyone has a purpose. If you dig down deep enough, you'll find that purpose. If you ask, and it's kind of like derived from that Simon Sinek, you know, ask yourself why. And I just feel like if you ask yourself why enough, you get down to that point. And I've done it for myself. So like my why is, to be the representation depending for my TikTok, my social media, my Chris Paul Rainbow stuff, it's to be the representation I never had as a kid. So every time I open up TikTok or social media, I try to think about that. Is this the Chris that younger Chris needed right now? When younger Chris reads this, what are they going to think? And then for my business, it's discover a brilliant truth. And so like, that's my purpose, is to find a brilliant truth in people that I find people don't see the beauty in themselves. And I have this gift of being able to meet someone and just look at them and hear them speak and go, this is your thing. This is who you are. I know what you care about. I can see it. And you know, if it comes to branding or marketing or anything like that, illustration, it's not about creating something that's not true. It's not about, you know, throwing a label on it and saying, this is what we are. It's about finding that truth that already exists and shining it up and going, hey, world, what about this? And putting that out there and being comfortable enough to put it out there. Because people, sometimes I show them this. I go, this is who you are. A lot of times they cry and they go, yeah, I don't know how to do that. I don't want to show that though. I'm scared of that part. I'm like, yeah, I totally understand you're scared of that part. And that's up to you whether you want it, but that's who you are. And it's beautiful and the world needs this. I love doing that because people, I don't know, they just don't see themselves. I think they're so close to themselves. They're like this, that I can like step back and go, whoa. And that's organizations too. I look at organizations, I go, I know you say you do this, but what you're actually doing is you're doing this. And they're like, we do that. Like I was talking to, actually it was a daycare place, and like, we watch children. And I was like, no, you don't watch children. We got to the point where it was like, no, you're giving mostly, I would say their audience was moms, working moms. I was like, you're giving them the ability to have a career, to be independent, to have all of the things that society says you can't have, you can't juggle all of those things. You're providing them with that, and you're providing them with the comfort that knowing that their most precious thing in the world is being taken care of while they're taking care of themselves. That's what you provide. You don't wipe kids' noses and change their dirty diapers. That's the brilliant truth. So start telling people about that.
The brilliant truth. I love that. And I think you're right. It's impossible for people to see that in themselves. It's really super powerful. Yeah, that's amazing. So a couple of other things that I just wanted to touch on, Chris.
Yeah.
I just have to hear you tell the story about the gake.
The gake! The gake heard around the world! Okay, I'll tell you the story of the gig. So basically, there was this guy in the States in 2016, and it was all over the news, and he was not baking a gay cake for this gay couple who wanted to get married. He's like, it's against my religion. It's not happening. And me and my husband had just got engaged, and I thought, are you kidding me? Like, you cannot do that. And I was like, I want a gay cake. And I was like, we're not even getting married for 2 years. But I was like, we'll celebrate something. Don't worry about it. So I called the local baker and I said, I want the gayest cake in the world. And they said, what does that mean? I said, if you sent it to a country that just, you know, hated gay people, they would set it on fire and just like be so mad. And they're like, okay, got it. So the next day I went in and they come out and there's this cake there and it's absolutely gorgeous. It's like this tall. It's got this big unicorn horn, all the rainbow colors. And then they did this thing at the bottom where they had every like saying and identity from like lesbian to like go queen to trans to love is love all around the bottom. And I was like, this is the gayest cake ever. And I looked at the baker, who's a friend of mine now after this, and I said, how did you know to make the gayest cake ever? And she said, I have two moms. And I was like, oh, perfect. Perfect. So I took it home, and my husband's like, ooh, we're going to eat it. I said, don't touch that cake until I get a picture. And I took a picture of it, and I put it onto social media. And I said, in Canada, when you ask for a gay cake, you get a gay cake. And I went to bed, and the next morning I woke up, and it was like millions of shares all over the place. And then over the past week, like, it was just nuts at my office, like all like The Advocate, BuzzFeed, Huffington Post. They were all calling me at the office. I had people around the world, like people were like in the Caribbean going, you're on the front cover of this page in Jamaica. Like, what's going on? People from like Germany and Senegal messaging me saying like, oh my gosh, it was just like, you know, we're not allowed to get married here, or like, we just got married and this was so beautiful. So a year later, I go back to Cake and Loaf, the bakery that I went to get it. And I went in and to get like just a coffee and a donut, and I see the cake again, and they gave it to this woman. And I looked at her and I just said, that's my cake. And she said, no, this is my cake. I said, well, why did you order this cake? And she said, oh, my trans kid just came out as trans, and they listened to this podcast, Let Them Eat Gake, and they love it, and they wanted the same cake as the one that they had on the podcast. And I just went, that was my cake. I'm the podcast. And she started to cry. We hugged each other. And that was just like a full, like we were just talking about, you have no idea the impact you make and the beautiful truth that you put out into the world. That was just one time, right? That was so beautiful. But how many other times have you, even like you, Bob, put things out there? You're never going to hear about it. That doesn't mean somebody wasn't changed. Like, if you're talking about alcoholism, addiction, you're saving lives. Like, you've saved lives that you're never going to hear that about. And I hope you know that. And, like, the gate. Yeah.
God, I love that. Yeah, it's just another example of those, you know, the sincerest pumpkin. Like, you saw this thing right? about this couple that couldn't get a wedding cake, and you did what came naturally. And of course, you could, never could have imagined that you'd be running, that it would have had the impact that it would have a year later on this woman in this bakery. It's just like, God, that's just magic.
Yeah. And it still comes up to this day. People are like, oh my gosh, you're the person from the cake. And I'm like, yeah, just Google gayest cake in the world. And it still comes back like what, 9 years later, it's still like top on Google. So yeah.
All right. This has been amazing. God, there's so many other things I was hoping to touch on, but we just went down some rabbit holes and I've absolutely loved it. Tell me what you're most excited about next, Chris.
Oh my gosh. I'm so excited about so many things. I have a podcast coming out called Sissy Fit, which is going to be a podcast to help. It's kind of like that journey of allyship I was talking about. It's to help straight heteronormative cis people become better allies and bet on their journey. So it's about working. It's kind of like got this theme of like 80s exercise video, like Sissy Fit. And sissy comes from like cisgender. Right. So Sissy Fit, I'm helping cisgender people. But it's got like this Olivia Newton-John like physical kind of thing. Oh, the photography is fantastic. So that's coming out. We're gonna talk about it. There's gonna be no judgment. I want to hear the things that you're all hearing so that we can squash the rumors and just, you know, get on the same team and build better allyship. So that's coming out in the fall now. And then I have my kids' book is coming out. I just got my publisher, and it's going to be on sale June 2026. And that June, I'm going to be going on a book tour all over Ontario for Pride. I'm trying to talk my husband. Oh, the book is called Guinea Pigs Don't Wear Pants. And it is about kind of breaking down gender, the construct of gender in a really fun way. And that animals don't really experience gender. Like my guinea pig's not waking up every day going, well, what am I going to make my husband for dinner? And should I put on pants or a dress? Like they don't care. They don't care. So that's coming out. In 2026. So I'm super excited about it. I think those are the two things. And anybody out there, am I allowed to plug my website?
Yes.
Oh,
fire away.
ChrisPaulRainbows.com. You can get all of the information. Follow me on TikTok. Follow me everywhere. Bob, I still hope you ask me that question about the billboard.
Well, I'm going to ask you right now. So,
okay.
If you had a giant billboard, Chris, that a million people would see and you could put anything on it, a picture, a meme, or a saying, what would it be?
I think it would be kinder, period. Please, period. Because I think if we all just were just a little bit kinder to each other, had a little more humanity and saw each other as human beings, the world would be better. So be kinder, please.
Chris, this has been absolutely amazing. I can't thank you enough.
I've had so much fun. Thank you.
Brilliant. Thanks again.
Thank you. Bye, everyone.
The Growth Mixtape Podcast with Bob Mathers is produced by Bespoke Projects. Music by Je M'appelle Walter Cronkite. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to follow and rate us. When you do this, it helps to raise our podcast profile so that more people can find us. If you want to connect, you can find me on LinkedIn using the link in the show notes.